Friends, as we continue now in worship, I invite you to hear these words from the Gospel of Luke, beginning in the 10th chapter with the 25th verse. Just then, a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he said, "what must I do? What must I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? What do you read there?" He answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind and with all your strength and with all your soul, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You've given the right answer. Do this, and you will live." But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, while traveling, came near him, and when he saw him, he was moved with pity. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, having poured oil and wine on them. Then he put him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said, 'Take care of him, and when I come back, I will repay you whatever more you spend.' Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" He said, "The one who showed him mercy." Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." Hear what the Spirit is saying.
Well, that is a very kind introduction. But to my fellow North Carolinians and the rest of you who watch television in the 20th century, I'll just have to say that my only real claim to fame is that all of my mama's people are from Mayberry. And my granny and her brothers lived there when Andy Griffith was growing up. And when he went out to Hollywood and wrote his story, he didn't bother changing all the names. So our Uncle Otis is the town drunk in the Andy Griffith. I'm grateful that you would have even a bootlegging Baptist like me into your church. Please pray with me this morning. Oh Lord, whenever you call women and men to preach, you run the risk of putting your treasure in earthen vessels, clay pots, liable to be cracked, we usually are. So I pray this morning that you would hide me behind your cross, that the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts might be acceptable unto you. O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. I first came to Washington, D.C. 20 years ago this fall from North Carolina, from that little country town in tobacco country. I was an ambitious young kid trying to make something of myself in the world, trying to do great things. So I had to come to Washington, D.C. I had written to our senior senator at the time, Jesse Helms, and he referred me to his senior colleague, Strom Thurmond from South Carolina, who welcomed me to be a page in his office over here on Capitol Hill. I'll never forget the first day on the job. I walked into his office. He was seated behind that big wooden desk. And he came around and he shook my hand and he looked me in the eye and he said, "Kid, be careful. This town isn't safe. These are dangerous streets." I didn't know enough history at the time to know that His imagination of dangerous streets was tied very closely to the politics of law and order that had allowed him to transition from his base of Southern Democrats to Republicans in the South at the end of the 20th century. I didn't know enough politics, really, to understand the way he and many like him embodied the Southern strategy that used that fear to divide poor white people from poor black people so that the folks who had always had the power could continue to have the power. I didn't know all of that at the time. But what I gathered from this greeting, from my welcome to Washington, D.C., was that a responsible young white man like myself needed to have a certain amount of fear and needed to be careful on these dangerous streets. And I imagine I would have done just that, would have stayed these last 20 years on the course that Senator Thurman and others imagined for me, if it hadn't been for Jesus, for those scriptures that my little church in King, North Carolina, made me memorize. In the King James Version, always, because if it was good enough for Jesus, it was good enough for us. We were sticking with it. So one day when I was walking very quickly to lunch down at Union Station, because what I learned in D.C. is that if you're here, you're important, and if you're doing important work, you have to be in a hurry. So I was in a hurry going down to get some lunch at Union Station, and on my way there, I passed on these dangerous streets. I passed a man who was sitting on the stairs, an African-American man. He was holding a styrofoam cup, and he asked me if I could spare some change. And I ignored the man, because all of my formation and everything Senator Thurmond had told me taught me that's what I should do. But when I got to the glass doors of Union Station, this doesn't happen to me every day, but it happened that day, I heard the voice of Jesus speak to me in the King James Version that I had memorized. Inasmuch as ye did not do it unto the least of these, my brethren, ye did not do it unto me. And I suppose that I'm back here in D.C. today as a preacher, and not as a politician, because Jesus interrupted me that day. And Jesus began to teach me the peculiar but good news of his gospel for people who live on dangerous streets. We are painfully aware this week that we do, in fact, live and move and have our being on dangerous streets. Streets that are more dangerous for some than for others. That's what Black Lives Matter has been teaching us. That's what our sisters and brothers have been crying out in the streets. But their cry is not new. It is as old as Emmett Till. It is as old as the lynching tree. It is as old as those Klan and other violent terrorist groups that formed to intimidate black people in the South, to tell them that their bodies were to be controlled by people who thought they were white. This is not new, but it is palpably present to us because we have seen it. Many of us who are not directly affected have seen it more closely by means of these video cameras that we carry around in our pockets now, and by means of the social media that can share what maybe some wouldn't want us to see. I know personally how difficult it can be to hear, to receive this reality, because 13 years ago when I moved into a historically black neighborhood in Durham, North Carolina, people told me these stories. People I went to church with, people who I knew, young people who I was teaching Bible study to and working with in after-school programs and summer camps, they told me what it was like to live on these streets, to be harassed by police officers, to be stopped and frisked, to be questioned, to be suspect from the time they were old enough to ride their bicycles on the street by themselves. I heard all of this, but I didn't feel it. I didn't learn to internalize it in my gut until one day when a young guy named George, I had known him since he was young. He was a young man by this time, and because of the violence on our streets, he had been shot and paralyzed. And after coming home from the hospital. He was living with us at our house. It happened to be the anniversary of his mother's death, his mother who had died when he was young. And George's friend knew that it was the anniversary and asked if he could come by and take him out for a bite to eat. We loaned them our family's minivan because it was easier for him to get in and out of his wheelchair into the van than in his friend's car, and so they went down the street. And after they had been gone a little while, I got a phone call from George that they had been stopped right around the corner by the police. I walked around in my pajamas. I had already gotten ready for bed, but I walked around and told the officer that it was, in fact, my van, and that if he needed any information about it, I was there. He told me he didn't need me. I could stand to the side, and so I did. And after watching him question these young men for some time, he came back to me, and he said, "I suggest you go somewhere safer. You need to understand these men may be armed and dangerous." I looked at the man and said, "I live with one of those guys. I gave him my van. I think I'll stay." And so I watched as they called the canine unit to come, and the dogs searched the car, and the guys were drug out on the sidewalk and frisked and left to stand there for nearly an hour because, as the officer said, they had stopped slightly beyond the stop sign, where I also have to go a little bit out into the street to look both ways to see if a car is coming. Being there, being present to that, and knowing those young men as my friends was the first direct experience I had of seeing, of feeling a little bit of what it must be like to know that no matter the humiliation, no matter the ordeal, you have to endure it because, after all, they have the guns and they have the prisons. It's an incredible reality that we are all being called to deal with by our sisters and brothers in the Black Lives Matter movement. And yet, at the same time, this week, we also are painfully aware of the fear that police officers have to carry with them in every one of these encounters. Even the best intentioned, even the purest of heart know that they too could not go home from these encounters. I was driving up here last night from North Carolina, where I live, driving up 95. I think it may be dangerous for preachers to drive on Saturday nights. I mean, maybe it's the worst kind of driving under the influence to be trying to listen to the Lord and driving on the highway at the same time. But I wasn't paying very close attention to just how fast I was going until I saw the blue lights in my rearview mirror and pulled over to the side. And the state trooper informed me that I was operating a motor vehicle at 83 miles an hour in a 70 mile an hour zone. I'll have to go back and deal with that at some point. But when he brought the ticket back to share with me, I received it and was apologetic. I didn't tell him what I was thinking about, but I said I was sorry I wasn't paying attention. And then I noticed that he was nervous. And so I said to him, "You know, thanks for being here. It must be scary out here this week." And he took a deep breath and sighed. And he dropped his head and he said, "It is." And I immediately remembered a few weeks ago a man who had come to see me because he had decided that he had to quit being a police officer. He had policed our neighborhood in Durham for 2 years. And had done it, as far as I could tell, for the best of reasons. He wanted to be a public servant. He wanted to do a job that would have him in the neighborhood, a Christian brother. And yet he had realized, in the course of doing his work, that wearing the uniform made him so suspect in the neighborhood that being a police officer made it impossible for him to be a neighbor. So he had had to resign his position and came to me to talk about what he might do next. This fear, this anxiety, this tension that so many have to carry is a reminder to us that we do, in a very real sense, live on dangerous streets. And so our gospel text today is important because it's good news for people who live on dangerous streets. Luke is at pains in the 10th chapter to point out to us that Jesus is a street preacher. Jesus does his preaching and most of his teaching as a mendicant, as one who walks about teaching as he goes, using object lessons that he passes along the way, and not gathering a congregation necessarily that is willing to sit for an hour, though I'm grateful you're here today. Jesus just takes the congregation that is available, that comes to him, that is attracted by his ministry. Jesus is a street preacher. And at the beginning of Luke chapter 10, Jesus makes it clear that his street preaching is not a sort of evangelistic crusade to build up enough of a crowd that he could have his own tent or congregation. No, Jesus is a street preacher who commissions his followers to also be street preachers. Luke chapter 10 begins with the sending of the 72. Jesus sends them out two by two to proclaim the message that the kingdom of God is at hand. And Jesus tells them to go out and live as he has, without home, without purse, to go out and preach that message. But it is clear that everyone who follows Jesus in Luke chapter 10 is called to preach this good news of the kingdom drawing near on dangerous streets. Except that some people, especially some of us religious people, we would prefer not to have to go out on the dangerous streets. It's notable to me, as someone with religious training, as someone with religious degrees, that it is a scholar of religion, a scholar of the religious law, who says to Jesus, let me make sure that you've got it all right. Let me ask you, teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus, who, for all of his walking around, still took the time to study the books, he gives the right answer. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, all your strength that is within you, and love your neighbor as yourself. Right answer, Jesus says. Now, go and do it, and you'll really live. But there's something in this man, something in this poor soul that may also be in us. It is a longing to know and to experience and to really live the life we were made for, and yet a hesitancy, a fear, a certain desire to be safe, to stay away from the dangerous streets. So Jesus tells a story. A story about that dangerous road from Jerusalem down to Jericho. That road that had many twists and turns, and that when people traveled, they were often vulnerable because they might be the only person on a stretch of road, and robbers and brigands could jump out of the bushes and ambush you easily. It was a dangerous road. Jesus tells a story that was very believable, a story about a man who was on that road and was jumped. And after being robbed, he was even stripped of his clothes and beaten and left for dead on the side of the road. Jesus says there were two religious people who passed him by. I think Jesus is incredibly insightful in telling us that there were two religious people. Because we religious people, especially those of us who take time to think about our religion, to do theology, we have an incredible capacity to imagine these divisions, to make distinctions, you know, the good people and the bad people, us and them. Maybe Jesus is suggesting that both our kind of religious people and their kind of religious people pass by on the road. I kind of imagine, with a bit of preacher license here, I kind of imagine that the first person who came along the road was a compassionate conservative. He passed by on the other side, not, of course, because his heart was hard, but for the best of reasons, he had to press on. He had to get to that meeting of that committee that was going to send relief workers to the road so that people who were in this situation might be able to get help. Perhaps he was even a businessman who had devoted his life to building up the economy so that there wouldn't be so many robbers and people who feel like they have to steal from someone else. Maybe he was that sort of conservative. I'm sure he passed for the very best of reasons. But he's not the only one who passed by, because, there's always the other people. I imagine that the religious figure who passed on the other side of the road was a very good-hearted liberal. Maybe he had been fighting for universal health care. And this brother who was in the ditch clearly needed access to Medicaid, and we still have 20-some states that are refusing to expand, so maybe he was going to a meeting to make sure that we can get this Affordable Care Act passed so that everybody can have medical attention when tragedies like this strike. Whatever the case, they both passed by for the best of reasons, I'm sure. And then Jesus notes that there was a Samaritan who came. You had to say Samaritan with a certain amount of scorn in the first century if you were talking to Jews, because the Samaritans were, as everyone knew, the absolute enemy. Not just us and them. They were the complete other. They were the terrorists. They were the ISIS of that day. The Samaritans were unimaginably different. As a matter of fact, Jesus had just come through Samaria traveling with the disciples, and Luke tells us that they were utterly rejected by the Samaritans because they were on their way to Jerusalem. Because they were associated with the temple cult of Jerusalem, they were rejected. And the disciples, feeling like most good Jews of the time would have, the disciples say, "Why don't we call down fire from heaven on them, Lord?" And Jesus says, "Oh, no, you don't have to do that. Let's keep going." But it is in the light of that, which has just happened the chapter before, that Jesus says a Samaritan came by. And behold what this Samaritan does on a dangerous road, especially in a week when we're painfully aware of how dangerous our streets are. This Samaritan doesn't cross over, doesn't pass by, but draws near to the suffering. This Samaritan takes the time to touch the wounds of this man who has been injured. He takes the time to wash him with what he has, wine and oil, to wrap his body. This Samaritan draws close and engages in the human connection that must have inspired some kind of lament. How can we live? How can we live when people are being shot down in the streets? How can we live in the face of such pain and such wounds and not weep? How can we live without drawing all the resources we have to cry out and lament, "How long, O Lord? How long shall this go on? Forever? My God, why have you forsaken us?" Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Sometimes it causes me to tremble. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Oh, the Samaritan brother, the Samaritan who stops on the side of the road, is inviting us to lament. What is more, he is showing us what lament can lead to. Because drawing near, touching the wounds, weeping the tears that must be wept when human beings see this kind of evil done to one another. This Samaritan is transformed. The Samaritan does precisely what Jesus has said to do in the Sermon on the Mount, to give to whoever asks. The Samaritan takes out of his own purse money to pay for this injured person's care. Furthermore, he leaves enough money for him to be cared for the next 2 months and says he'll be back by then and will pay the rest of the bill if there's anything less. He has been caught up in God's economy. This person who is unimaginably different from everyone who has heard Jesus, from everyone who is following Jesus, this is the one that is showing us what God's love looks like in practice. Back in 2003, my wife Leah and I were in Iraq with a group called the Christian Peacemaker Teams. CPT was part of the Iraq Peace Team, which had built up a presence there when President Bush, who was in the White House at the time, had declared that he was going to bomb the country if Saddam and his sons did not leave. And so we were there when the bombs started falling, and we visited people whose homes and churches and places of work were ruined by the so-called strategic strikes, which, as we saw, had a good bit of collateral damage. But after about 2 weeks of being there, the Iraqi regime, Saddam's regime, that had not yet crumbled, became very nervous about our presence as Americans and kicked us out of the country. Kind of like those Samaritans ushered Jesus and the disciples right on through. They knew that our people were not their people, and so they cast us out. And as we were driving west from Baghdad on that road, that very dangerous road, that had been bombed for 2 weeks, where bridges had collapsed, where cars were burned and shrapnel was scattered, one of our cars hit a piece of that shrapnel and blew the tire. It careened into a ditch, and three guys on our team split their heads open in the middle of a desert, in the middle of a war. They didn't know what they were going to do. But a car of Iraqis stopped, took them into their car, and drove them to a town called Rutba. And in Rutba, they met a doctor who spoke very clear English and said to them, 3 days ago, your country bombed our hospital, but we will take care of you. And he sewed up their heads and saved their lives. I was in a car in front of that car. We didn't even see it wreck at first, and so it took us some time to get back and to find them and to find this doctor at Rutba. But when we found them, we thanked this doctor for what he had done, and I asked him if we owed him anything for his services, and he said, no. Please just go and tell people what's really happening here in Rutba. And so I came back to the United States in 2003 telling that story every time I had the chance. And the more I told it, the more I realized that it was the Good Samaritan story. That the good Iraqi, the good Muslim had gone out of his way, several of them had gone out of their way, to show us what God's love looks like. When we had made ourselves their enemies when our country was bombing them. I think that's what Jesus is trying to say to us with this story on this week of very dangerous streets. Keep your eyes open, Jesus says. We have to lament. We have to draw near, and yet we don't even know how. Whether we're compassionate conservatives or broad-minded liberals, we hardly know how to draw near to the pain, to pull back those layers and layers of America's original sin, to get down to what has infected us for so, so long. And yet, God is sending people who can show us the way. Maybe the most unlikely of friends, the most surprising of allies are in our streets. They are crying out. And they are inviting us to join them, to join our street preacher Jesus and his sisters and brothers in following this way that leads to the life that is really life. That is what it means. The whole tradition tells us to love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. It is to love your neighbor as yourself. And as the 4th century desert father, Dorotheus of Gaza, said, it is as if we are all on a great circle, with God at the center. And from any point at which you move closer toward God, you will find you're moving closer to your neighbor. Even the most unlikely of neighbors, even the people we've imagined to be our enemies, can become our teachers in this way that Jesus is showing us.